In today's New Testament reading, James teaches us about wisdom. What is wisdom? Is it the same thing as smarts? Is there only one kind of wisdom and you either have it, or you have some of it, or you don't? How does a person or a community or a culture gain and live in wisdom? All kinds of good questions could fill a whole notebook when pondering this. One way to think of wisdom is to contrast it with knowledge. You know, life wisdom versus head knowledge. There's a commercial on the radio in which the speaker praises the value of experts and the value of regular people too, implying that experts aren't regular people somehow. But it's not hard to see the point. An expert on climate tells you how much carbon is in the atmosphere and how it compares to the amount millions of years ago from her analysis of ice core samples in the Arctic. A regular person is a farmer who's learning to adapt because his crops aren't growing like they used to. Knowledge and wisdom. A knowledgeable expert says the storm in the Gulf is churning and it looks like it's going to rapidly intensify because the pressure in the eye is dropping rapidly. The person of wisdom says it might be time to board up the windows and get out of town. So you get the idea. Knowledge and wisdom. Somebody taught me recently the difference is knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is knowing not to add it to a fruit salad. Knowledge and wisdom. Wisdom is not just knowing information, it's the way you understand what that information means, what it means for you, how it helps explain life and the great and grand purposes of life. The whole book of Proverbs is written to help young people develop wisdom about life and the world around them as they grow older. Humans have gained tremendous knowledge about the world since the time Proverbs was written. It's not clear that we've exceeded its wisdom. The book of James is a little like Proverbs. It reads a little like Proverbs, but James, writing to Christian communities, adds an element to the discussion about wisdom. For James, there are two kinds of wisdoms. Wisdoms. Not just one. There's two kinds. The world's wisdom and God's wisdom. Now, for James to call them both wisdom is a little confusing to read, but he has in mind there's two ways to follow the world's wisdom and God's wisdom. Wisdom is the way you make sense of the world and operate in it. Wisdom of either kind is a framework, a system, a scaffolding for how the world works and for how you should live. For James, there's a world's way, a world's wisdom, and there's God's way, God's wisdom. And James is salty about this. So salty. Chapter 1. If you think you're living God's way and you don't bridle your tongue, you deceive your heart, and your religion is worthless. For those of you who've just been cut off in traffic, James is salty. Chapter 2, here you are, look at you. Look how you favor the rich and how you shame the poor. Aren't the rich ones the ones who are oppressing you? Aren't they opposed to everything you stand for? Why are you tripping over yourself to get noticed by them? Salty. What good is it for you to say you have faith, but you don't do anything with it to love your neighbor, to care for the person nearby you? Your faith is useless. Chapter 3, who is wise? By their good conduct, let them show their works in gentleness, born of God's wisdom. If you have bitter envy and selfish ambition in your heart, don't boast that you have God's wisdom. You have an earthly way of life, the worldly way of life. It's not spiritual, except you might say it's of an evil spirit. Whoa, James is salty. Doesn't have time to mess around or be nice. James doesn't have time for all that. He's far too aware of the dangers of the way the world turns Christians into envious, selfish, ambitious evildoers. Submit yourself to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you, James says, chapter 4. With James, we can recognize how insidious the two traits he mentions are in the human heart: envy and ambition. Envy is to desire what other people desire, learning to desire what others desire precisely because they desire it. It's a form of idolatry in which people idolize both their neighbors and their neighbor's desires until they relentlessly try to acquire the object of the other's desire. You want to become someone else. You want what they have and who they are. You shall not covet is one of the anchor commandments to sustain the people of God, a law given not just to direct individuals to pure hearts, but also to protect the community from the poison of envy. If we learn from the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve envy God's position over their own and desire to make it their own, if we learn from the 10th commandment, if we learn from James' warning here, we search our hearts for traces of envy and jealousy of others. We confess it, and we ask God for peace in its place, a peace that passes understanding and surpasses our envy. The other warning of James is equally as dangerous. Selfish ambition is a radical individualism that serves only the ambition, the desire, the good of myself. The other day, I muddied the words selfish ambition into shambition. And then I decided that's pretty good, so I'm sticking with it. It's shambition. With shambition, I'm looking out for number one in all things, whether it's for the good of others or creation or even my future self. I'm looking out for number one, me, myself, I, right now. Shambition can justify any actions, justify any means to serve myself. The root word for shambition is an old Greek word, and it's just one word, which backs up etymologically speaking, my reduction of this to just one English word. The root is an old Greek word from wool making, to spin. Ancient Greeks used the word to describe a politician who will do anything and say anything and spin anything to get what he wants. That person is not seeking good or truth or the good of the city. He's seeking to win for himself or his team. Basically, it's a college sports internet message board become sentient. Shambition sees the world as zero sum. If you get something more, it means I get something less. You must decrease so I can increase. If we learn from Judas' betrayal of Jesus, from David's son Absalom dishonoring his father, the throne, and the kingdom, if we learn from Jesus, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. If we learn from James' warning, we search our hearts for traces of selfish ambition. We confess it, and we ask God for love and compassion in its place. The Christian community, then and through all time, is a gift and a challenge to live by a different sort of wisdom than these, to learn to live with God's wisdom. Those who live by the way of the world will have their lives characterized by envying what other people have and who other people are. Their lives will be shaped by the desire to possess and consume, and that desire will never be satisfied. It's a hole you try to fill by digging deeper. A person's life so shaped by desire and consumption is a person whose consumption brings no joy. Those who live by the way of the world will live for themselves It is as if they are living by themselves in competition with everyone else toward their destruction. In the 1800s, Charles Darwin explosively explained that the world works just this way. A natural world designed to work through competition to death. The strong survives, the weak dies. Some people took this idea and applied it to human relationships in society. They called it social Darwinism, justifying human injustices between rich and poor. As each person pursues their own gain, the strong get richer, and if they trample, abuse, and kill the poor while they're doing it, well, that's just how the world works. They blamed that thought on old Darwin. Envy and the relentless consumption fueled by it, and shambition and the radical individualism it births, are so prevalent around us that I'm not sure Darwin or we can even recognize it. I was recently reminded of the little parable-ish story that David Foster Wallace shared in a commencement address years ago to a group of college graduates. He said, "There's two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way who nods at them and says, 'Morning, boys, how's the water?' The two young fish swim on a little bit, and then eventually one of them looks over at the other and goes, 'Hey, what's water?'" Wallace said the point of the fish story is merely that the most obvious, important realities are often the ones that are hardest to see and talk about. Recent scholars have noted that Darwin himself was seeing the world that he was observing and studying through the lens of his social location. When he observed the natural wonders of the Galapagos, he was thoroughly formed by the social relationships of early 19th century British Industrial Revolution. He saw nature, in part, as only cutthroat competitive because the world he lived in among humans was cutthroat competitive. And this is a very interesting observation. Darwin's culture of competition and industry and individualism shows up right there in how he says the world must work. And he didn't even know it. We're so enmeshed in a particular culture and economy characterized by envy and selfishness, I'm not sure how we have the capacity to even know it when we see it. In the culture, in others, or particularly in ourselves. It's like this is who we are. It's our default mode of being, our water in the little parable. What's water? Our culture, the water we swim in, is a fast-moving, muddy river of individualism, narcissism, pursuit of wealth and comfort, idolatry of personal freedom to operate as if you're alone at the center of creation. Or as James puts it, a wisdom thoroughly leveraged by envy and shambition. David Foster Wallace was salty too as he tried to describe our water to those graduates about to go into the real world, those bright-eyed graduates about to go, you know, change the world. He said to them, the so-called real world will not discourage you from operating on your default settings, because the so-called real world of men and money and power hums merrily along in a pool of fear and anger and frustration and craving and worship of self. Our own present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that have yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. The freedom all to be lords of our tiny, skull-sized kingdoms alone at the center of all creation. This kind of freedom has much to recommend it. But of course, there are all different kinds of freedom. And the kind that is most precious, the kind that is most precious, you will not hear much talk about in the great outside world of wanting and achieving. The really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad ways, myriad ordinary ways every day. There's two kinds of wisdom, the wisdom of the world's ways and the wisdom of God. We might also recognize there's a third wisdom, the wisdom of the earth. Jesus drew on the wisdom of the earth all the time. How many parables began with sayings like, look at the fig tree, consider the soil, look at the clouds? And I get the idea his first century audience could hear him and nod and say, I see that. Today we read that and we have to go consult commentaries. I have no idea what he's talking about. Figs grow on trees and don't just come in little squares. Mustard comes from mustard plants and not just yellow squirt bottles. How interesting. Does honey come from little bear-shaped squeeze bottles? How bizarre. But Jesus recognized that there are really two wisdoms. One is the wisdom of humans and all they do toward envy and ambition. And the other is the wisdom of God, which can also be seen sometimes in the way of the earth. If you have eyes to see and ears to hear. On Wednesday, Butch Tindell, our farmer friend, gave us eyes to see. He said this to us. He said, if you scoop up in your two hands a pound of good soil, you're holding 900 million forms of life, from single-cell microorganisms to earthworms and beetles. And he said gently, we were taught that everything in nature is in competition with one another to the death. And because we were taught that, industrial farmers became soldiers in the war for dominance of the soil. Butch said a farmer friend of his said that he would wake every morning with only one question: what am I going to kill today? What weed, what bug, what fungus shall I spray and kill? That's my only job as a farmer. When he realized that, it's when he left industrial farming practices and transitioned everything he did to learn how to care for the soil. He returned to growing things, not killing things. He turned to life, not death. Butch said, we're learning that the true wisdom of the soil is that there's more cooperation than competition than what we were taught. Those 900 million forms of life in a scoop of good soil need one another. They depend on one another. And they seem to work together as a community for the good of the whole. What wisdom is there in that for us humans? Is there some of God's wisdom in that somewhere, in that scoop of good soil? Can good soil be a parable of good life? It can in the hands of Jesus. If there was an era of imperialistic, racist, social Darwinism, what just might dawn in an era of social, regenerative, cooperative soilism? James has eyes to see a harvest of righteousness sown in peace by those who make peace. Jesus calls us to be servants of one another, to be servants of all. God's wisdom is pure, peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial, sincere. The good soil of this fruit is the church in the world, a community of those men and women who wake each day not asking, "What must I kill today in the garden of life?" but who ask, "How can we all live, truly live? Where is life teeming? Where is God bringing life from death? And on this day, how can I tend and keep the garden of God and feed the world, that God might bless us all and keep us and make his face to shine upon us and lift his pleasure upon us and through us give the world peace?" May this be our prayer. Amen.